Good morning. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Robert Cornelius. That's spelled C-O-R-N-E-L-I-U-S, and Robert goes by Bob. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Tuesday, May 29th, 2018. And Bob, can you tell me how old you are?
I'm 70 years old.
Where were you born?
I was born in Oakland, California.
What were your parents doing in Oakland?
My parents actually lived in Richmond at the time. My mom and dad were both from Oklahoma. My dad had, when he was about 17 or maybe younger, he hopped a freight like so many people did during the Depression. And headed for California. He had had some relatives in the Antioch area, which is in Contra Costa County, and is kind of along the extension of the bay there, where it goes into the Delta.
Okay.
And kind of an industrial area, and so he had some contacts there, and of course he was looking for work. My mom, my grandfather was a tunneler, and he came to California to build the help with the Los Angeles Aqueduct.
Oh wow!
And then later they moved to the Bay Area, and he was a worker on the what at that time was called the Broadway Low Level Tunnel, now called the Caldecott Tunnel, that goes between Contra Costa County, Walnut Creek area, where I grew up. And the Oakland Berkeley area. It goes through the hills there.
Okay.
And my mom, along with my granddad and grandma, lived in and her sisters lived in Lafayette, California, which is east of where the tunnel was being built. And so that's where my mom lived. My grandparents then moved to Berkeley and lived on Telegraph Avenue just a few blocks from the University of California for many, many, many years.
Really?
Like 40 years. And my mom lived with them there, and she went to the University of California for a couple of years, and she dropped out, and she had been introduced to my dad, and they lived in Antioch for a while, and then as the my dad got a job working in the shipyards in Richmond, and then eventually that turned into the Liberty Ship program, and my mom was a Rosie the Riveter. She went and worked in the shipyards there also, and my brother had been born by that time. I have one older brother. His name is Jerry, and my mom's name is Marjorie, or was Marjorie, and my dad's name was Earl. And my brother and my parents lived in there in Richmond. And I think after he was born, I think she didn't do as much. I guess after when my dad went to the war, he finally he got drafted into World War II, served on Okinawa, and when he left, I think she did not work in the shipyards as much as she had previously, and then after the war, I was born, and we lived in Richmond until I was about two and a half years old. And my mom, one of the things she did, the government housing they were living in Richmond, they were starting to close that. And so they were finding themselves, without any place to go to live. And housing was pretty tight in the Bay Area. There was a lot of construction and stuff starting. And my mom went over to a radio station in San Francisco, and she got on the air. They had this program, sort of like nowadays occasionally you have a program where people are advertising things on the radio. You know, I want to buy a car, or
yeah.
I've got this tractor for sale or something. She went over there and and asked about finding a place to live.
Oh, neat.
Her and my dad, my brother needed a place to live, and myself at that time. And the on-air ad was answered by a I'm forgetting the name of the person that answered the ad in Walnut Creek, but anyway, they moved out to were able to move out to Walnut Creek. They came up with some sort of a rental arrangement. In fact, I think my dad had a thing where the landlord forgave part of the rent if we would pick all the walnuts off the walnut trees. There were 10, well, actually,
oh,
there were 20 walnut trees around this property. And so the my brother, I'm sure, and my parents would pick these walnuts every year for this guy, and Mr. Taylor was his name. And,
so, hey, Bob, hang on a second. I've got some questions.
Yes, sir.
So your grandfather was out in California working on a tunnel that ended up coming through the mountains there toward Oakland and Berkeley. Was that a tunnel for water?
No. This was a traffic tunnel.
Traffic tunnel. Okay.
Yeah, there had been several tunnels built at higher elevation in the mountain, and this one, the reason it was called Broadway Low Level Tunnel is it was down pretty much at the level that the valley came up from Orinda, to then, you know,
got it,
where it came out in Oakland.
That was a huge amount of work to do that, and I'm
it was
kind of
it
going
was,
into some
yeah.
detail. Orinda is of course east of Berkeley. There's
right.
some fairly substantial hills there. So the concept was just a simple horizontal grade through the mountain.
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And his name was Edgar Baugh. He was from Choteau, Oklahoma. That's where my mom was born. And
how do you spell Baugh?
You know, B-A-U-G-H.
Thank you.
And E-D-G-A-R. He didn't have a middle name, just Edgar Baugh. And he was actually the first... He started work the first day of the tunnel, and he ended the last day of the tunnel. He was the only man that did that.
Wow.
There were other people that came and went. But he was like a night, I don't want to say supervisor, that's not what I'm saying, crew boss, I guess, night crew boss. So he was there at night. I guess it didn't make any difference because you're underground
right.
anyway.
Right.
So, but they worked on that for several years before they got through. They had a lot of problems with different types of geologic issues with
right.
Faults, hard
and
rock, soft rock,
yep.
Water infiltration. Mm. You know, I don't know if they had any hot water problems, but they had a lot of issues.
Okay.
And he used to talk about one time he got they had a trench, and he got buried in the trench right up to his neck.
Wow.
And my grandfather was really a sharp guy, and he was able to stay composed, and he instructed his men how to get him out. I think he probably had health problems as a result of that burial, his latter part of his life. But he later worked for an outfit called Duncan Harlson, and they were a pile driving outfit. And he drove piles in the bay, all over the bay, and repaired and built wharves. And he used to tell a story about going out to Alcatraz Island, and they had to repair the wharf where the boat came in with the prisoners and the guards and the
yep.
the foodstuffs and everything else. And he said it was kind of unnerving all day as they worked, where the guards stood around with machine guns,
did your dad do after the war, after he came
my
back from
dad,
service?
My dad originally, you know, was looking for different types of jobs, but he eventually became a welder, boilermaker welder. He was in the union, and that was his career, you know, the rest of his life. He one of the things I think that was a real positive influence was that he was home every night. He told my mom one time, he said, you know, there were these guys that go off, boilermaker welders often are all over the country.
Yeah.
And, you know, doing different jobs. My dad never left the Bay Area. I think the farthest he ever went was probably Stockton, which was about an hour's drive. There were a couple times he took jobs elsewhere. He went down to Morro Bay one time for an extended period of time. And then he had a few other jobs. I think he might have done something in the North Pacific Northwest for a short period of time. But most of the time, he was at home, and he was at home every night. And I think that was a positive,
okay. All right,
really
let's,
a positive influence.
Let's go back a little bit to Walnut Creek, where your mom's been on the radio, and you guys basically were able to get a place to rent in exchange for rent where you were picking walnuts. Do walnuts fall to the ground, or do you have to get on high ladders to get up to them?
No, what you do is you use what we did. There are two ways. If it's done, the easy way is to bring a dozer in or a small tractor in. They hook cable around the tree, and they hook the cable to the front of the tractor, and it has a shaker on it, and they literally shake the tree.
Okay.
That's how they do it, sort of an industrial way, you know, or a commercial way.
Hmm.
What we would do is we had cane poles. They do the walnuts do naturally fall at some point, but to speed the process up, you'd have these cane poles, big long ones. They might be 16 feet tall or something, and you or even 20 foot, and you hit the walnuts on the tree. The walnuts fall to the ground. And they have husks on them, and these are English walnuts that we had. They were big trees, and the husks have this oil. If you don't wear gloves, your hands turn black. And I went to school all the time. I'd get lazy, you know, when I was helping them in the latter years, and I'd have this blackish, purplish stain all over my hands. You know, that was just there were other kids. You'd look around the classroom, there'd be other kids there with black purple hands too.
And so you've got this long pole and you're looking up. You need to be careful that the walnuts didn't hit you on the head as they came down.
Maybe not. Yeah, I think we were good enough to get out of the way of that. But it was a lot of work, you know. I mean you had to, we would get sometimes you know, maybe up to 50 sacks or so off
wow.
of these trees. We had 10, we ended up with 10 trees. They ended up selling, my parents ended up selling off part of the property. They came into an agreement with this Mr. Taylor to eventually buy the property.
Oh, nice.
And
wow.
I think my dad and mom bought it for almost 2 acres for about $5,000.
Wow.
Or something
back
like
in
that.
The day.
Back in 1949, and when they retired in the 90s, they sold it for the three quarters of an acre they still had. They sold it for almost $1 million. So
yeah.
that just shows you how the price of property has gone up, but also the area has totally changed. When I was a kid, Walnut Creek was only a few thousand people, maybe 5,000-6,000 people in the city proper, and the surrounding areas were all truck farms, fruit and walnut orchards, and you know, it was a really a great place to grow up, because you could just run wild. You know, there weren't any fences, there were a few neighbors, and I used to go out and just graze on fruit all summer long, because we had you had apricots, cherries, plums, peaches, pears, persimmons, if you could stand those, and just a whole variety, pomegranates, variety of
Wow.
Fruit, and then grape arbors. There were several grape arbors in the area, and it was a fun place to grow up, you
I'm
know.
trying to
And
put this in perspective. Walnut Creek is just, is that just east of Berkeley?
it's east of Berkeley, you know, across this hill, these ranges of hills that we were talking about earlier about the tunnel going through,
Right.
and it's in a valley called the Ignacio Valley, and the other surrounding towns are you know, San Ramon, Alamo, and then to the north you have Martinez, which was the county seat where the John Muir National Historic Site is, if you've ever been there,
You know, what I was
and
thinking
then
of was
Concord, Pleasant Hill. What was that?
I believe it was 1923, the Great Berkeley Fire, and it started in Walnut Creek and whipped up over the hill and down the other side, down into Berkeley.
Well, I know I know the Berkeley Fire was on the north end of Berkeley.
Right.
I went to the University of California, and I took a class one time on I guess it was California history, and we actually went out and looked at where the fire had come. You could still see where the fire was because the architecture of the city changed. It changed from 1920s architecture to a little more modern, or excuse me, the other way around. It turned into 1920s architecture as opposed to even earlier architecture. So
Yeah, I mean, one thing they got
it
rid of
was fascinating to
was
see.
wood clap siding and shake shingles and
That's right,
got
those
rid of all
shake
that
shingles, they
to
did.
slate and stucco. I was like, all right, we're gonna
Yeah,
take care of this.
that's right.
Okay, I digress. I'm sorry. So
Okay, it's okay.
it sounds like upbringing in Walnut Creek, like you say, you could free range all summer. There were no fences. Did you camp out?
We would these walnut trees, you know, it gets hot in Walnut Creek. It will get up to 100 degrees sometimes, and in the summer. And what we would do in the early years that we lived there is during the summer, my parents had these box springs, and we would put big mattresses on them, and we put them out under the walnut trees, and then we would sleep out under the trees all night,
Oh,
especially on the really
nice.
hot nights. And I did that for forever. I mean, until I went away to college, I was still sleeping out under the trees at night, you know,
Nice.
in the summer. As far as other types of camping in the area, oh, there were a couple times I think we went down and down to the Walnut Creek maybe and spent the night, but mostly our camping adventures were in Yosemite. And my dad he really loved Yosemite, and he called it the Valley. We went up to the Valley, and we had this 49 Ford, and he hooked it up where he could put a little trailer, utility trailer on the back, and we would camp in style, you know. And
Wow.
we'd go to the near where Curry Meadow is there, and he would string ropes between the trees and put tarps over the ropes, and then he had this big umbrella tent, and he'd put that thing up, and we'd have cots around, and that really was influential thing for me to go to Yosemite. We went almost every summer for you know, a couple of weeks or so, and
So this would
just
have
had a lot
been
of fun
the
down
late
there.
1950s.
Yeah, this would have been the 50s and into the maybe the early 60s. I think I quit the last time I was in Yosemite was probably right after I graduated college, which was in 1969, 68, I think I went up there. And it had changed a lot. You know, you always go back to a place just like the Grand Canyon that we're going to discuss later. you go back to a place thinking it's going to be the same, and things have changed, you know, as far as the development, the number of visitors, and those types of things.
Sure. Did you get a sense then, as a boy, I'm assuming around 10, 10, 12, 13, of the National Park Service and presence of the Park Service, or was it for you more you know, this is just a part of an extension of my Walnut Creek backyard, and this is a great place to explore around, or both?
Well, maybe a combination. I mean, we love to go there and hike and swim and take inner tubes down the river and all those various things, you know, hike up to the falls and whatnot. That was all great. I remember when I was 8 or 9 years old, my mom took me on a naturalist walk in a meadow near El Capitan. And I can remember right then starting to think, you know, wouldn't this be wonderful to wear that uniform and work in the national in these parks that are so beautiful.
Nice.
And so I had thought about, you know, becoming a park ranger. In fact, I actually wanted to be a park naturalist was my original goal. But when I got to Grand Canyon, I remember, I looked at what the so-called naturalist or interpreters, as we call them now, were doing. They were spending time at the visitor center desk, and yeah, they were giving a few walks, and they were giving evening programs, but it looked like the park rangers were the ones having all the fun, you know, and
yeah.
Getting to actually get out in the park and see it without having to be so much behind a desk. So as my thoughts evolved, after I'd moved to Grand Canyon, that first summer, I thought, well, I think I'm going to pursue the park ranger aspect of the service if I can, rather than the interpretive aspect. But I've never lost interest in that sort of thing, you know.
Okay.
But Yosemite was a very influential place on me. I know I used to go. My parents had let me go to the evening programs. In those days, it was called Camp 14, and I think it's probably, I don't know, Stoneman Camp, or I'm not sure what the name of the camp is now. It's right across from what used to be Camp Curry.
Okay. And, yeah, I wouldn't know that.
Yeah, but that was really an important part of my life. I remember my dad, my dad passed away about in 1996, and he and my mom had sold their property. Like I told you, they got a lot of money for their property in Walnut Creek. They retired in Honolulu, Hawaii, and they were over there for a couple of years, and my dad got very sick. And I went over to see him, and I remember talking to him, I can't remember the exact conversation, but it was something to the effect that I mentioned, you know, gee, I wish we'd gone a few other places. And he said, well, maybe we went to Yosemite too many times. And I said, oh, no, I said, that's not the case. You can't go to Yosemite too many times. I said, and really all those trips to the valley, you know, really helped kind of mold who I am.
Nice.
Today, you know, and what I ended up doing. So, you know, it was just a really influential thing. There were some other people and some other things that kind of influenced my wanting to be a park ranger or
like
at least be in the outdoors. We had a next door neighbor, and her name was Norma Warner. And Norma was an older woman. In fact, she had a mother that was even older than her, you know, in those days when, you know, They were my age.
Yeah.
But anyway, Norma took care of her mother, and her father died, and she took care of her mother. And Norma worked for one of the big publishing companies in San Francisco. And she'd get on the train every day in the old days in the Sacramento Northern, and would go to the city every day, work at the publishing house, come home. And of course, later on, she got a car, and after the train was defunct in the 1940s, they probably did away with going to the city, but I'm not sure. Anyhow, Norma was a member of the local National Audubon Society, and she had a yard that had huge bushes around and fountains, bird fountains and little ponds, and it was really a real haven for a lot of bird life and stuff. And I'm not sure how I got interested in going over and chatting with her, but eventually she took an interest in myself and some of the other kids in the neighborhood. And we would do things like collect butterflies, and we would she gave us bird books and stuff, so we, she was very interested in birds. And then I started going on trips with her around the Bay Area with the local Audubon Society, and we went to places like Bay Farm Island, which is now the Oakland International Airport, and we went to Mount Diablo and Mount Tamalpais and some of these
Wow,
various places
neat.
around the Bay Area.
And you would have
But
been 12, 13,
yeah, I
14?
was fairly young then. It was
9, 10?
Boy, that's hard to remember back, but I'm guessing that was probably fairly close, maybe 8 to 13, 14 years old, maybe.
Okay.
And so I got my first, we were hiking in some very cool areas, Tilden Park, Redwood Regional Park, like I said, Mount Diablo, and then out in the Delta of California, the San Joaquin, Sacramento Delta. We would go on the winter bird counts and those types of things. And I met a lot of other, interesting people on these on these trips. I remember one guy named Harry Cuden, and I'm not sure how to spell that. Cuden, I guess.
Thank you.
He was the kind of the bird whistler in the group,
Oh,
and he could
wow.
imitate all these bird calls, and of course I was fairly young and wild, and so being with this group, I was seeing some really cool stuff outdoors for a young kid, but I was also making a lot of noise and scaring the birds away. So I don't know if I was always wanted on the trips, but it was a lot of fun. One time, I know we had a meeting in Walnut Creek, and she had me bring a report I'd written about hawks and what hawk how hawks behave, what they eat, all these things. And I read it in front of this the group there, which was kind of scary for a young kid, but
Yeah.
that was an opportunity to speak in public as a young kid, and that was probably helpful to me.
Nice. Who else was instrumental in helping you at that time? Sort of
Well,
formative.
I would say, of course, my mom, my dad,
Yep.
my brother, he was 8 years older than me. I was always, and I know he had to babysit me, when I was young, and so as some older, most older brothers are, I suppose, he was a little rough on me at times, And he got in a lot. My brother got in trouble occasionally, and he, I guess he was the best negative, positive influence in my life, if that makes sense. You know, he would
so
always do something,
he
and
taught
I'd
you
and I'd learn from it in a positive way.
What not to do?
Negative behavior. Had been.
Yeah. Well, he would have been Jerry would have been 16 when you were 8. I mean, just
putting
the numbers together. So
that's right. And he, as time went on, I saw less and less of him.
Mm.
So I guess I was almost like an only child at least part of the time, you know.
Okay.
But I recall one time he came home. It was a Saturday morning, and he'd been out partying on Friday night, and I was in the kitchen sitting in the. We had a little rocking chair there. I was sitting in there watching cartoons or something. And he walked in, and and he had his eye was almost closed, and he had a big cut under his eye on his cheek, and his lip was split open. And you know, he said, I said, "What in the world happened to you?" And he said, "Well, I got in a little fight, you know, and he said, but, you know, the old line, but you should see the other guy." And I said, "Well, boy, he must really look horrible, you know, you're a mess." So I never really liked to fight much after that.
Yeah.
You know?
Good.
But he was, you know, he's a great guy. We still get some real good laughs about our childhood times together.
Nice.
When I call him and talk, you know.
So as you were heading off into high school, were you thinking about going to college? Was that, because it doesn't sound like college was something that your mom had been in some college.
My mom was a school teacher.
Okay.
I don't think I didn't mention that.
Ah.
She taught fourth grade most of her career. And that was another kind of interesting thing. My mom used to take me, and we went around, we did some cool things. We went to a lot of the 21 California missions and other historical areas. And I know she took me to Sonoma, and we went over to Mission Dolores, of course, in San Francisco. And Carmel was our favorite down in Monterey.
Hmm.
Went down there several times and saw that. And she... also took me one time when I was a little bit older. She was going to San Francisco State College, taking a geography class, and we got on a DC-3 aircraft out at the old San Francisco airport, and her professor was on the flight with all the students, and we flew all over California, Northern California. We flew from San Francisco, of course, across where we lived. I even saw my house when we flew over, you know.
Cool.
I saw the whole Bay Area. We made a beeline for Yosemite, and we flew around Half Dome and the valley. We went then north up to Lake Tahoe, and I think we landed in Chico. And then we took off and went across the Central Valley, across Clear Lake, out to the Pacific Ocean, and came right down along where Point Reyes is, and over the Golden Gate, and landed again in San Francisco. And but the whole time we were on this flight, it was all day. This geography professor was showing students, you know, what we were seeing as far as landforms.
Wow.
And the cultural geography of the area and everything. It was really. Really a wonderful trip. But my mom and dad both, one thing I'd say about both of them is that they were always so encouraging. You know, when you would get despondent about something, they would encourage you. Or if you did something, you know, it was like the greatest thing that anybody had ever done, you know, whether it was artwork or something you'd written or something. There was another thing that happened when I was like about 12 or so, and that was I joined the Boy Scouts of America.
Ah.
And I had a scoutmaster named Charles Piper, or Charlie Piper. And he was really a wonderful guy, and you know, he cared so much about all of the boys. We were like, you know, like family to him. And I learned a lot in Boy Scouts. You know, we went on a lot of campouts. Some of them were a little bit rough, you know, as far as weather and everything else, and how, you know, Boy Scouts tend to make mistakes around the fireplace and, you know, cooking and all those kinds of things. But I learned a lot of outdoor skills with the Boy Scouts, and my dad went along on several trips. We went down to the Pinnacles National Monument, I remember, and dad went along. And then there was one scout camp we went to a couple of times that was right above the city of Kensington, and in the hills. When you were in the camp, you wouldn't know there was this gigantic metropolitan area on the other side of the hill, you know. You just walked up a little ways up from where the campsites were up onto the hill. You could look over the entire San Francisco Bay.
Wow.
And but down in the other side was pretty wooded and not any wilderness by any means, but you know, it was a fun place to go. And I learned a lot, and I think I you know, as far as character building also, the Scouts were really instrumental in you know, helping keep me on the straight and narrow, you know. And then also this next-door neighbor, Mrs. Warner, Norma Warner, she used to give me Christmas gifts, and she would, you know, like a book or something, and she worked with this, I think it was Macmillan Publishing. In San
okay,
Francisco.
That makes sense.
And she one time said, well, you know, I've retired now, and I don't have as much money, and so I don't think this is going to be the last year I'm going to give you a Christmas gift.
Hmm.
I thought, well, okay, that's fine. And she said, I'm going to give you a membership to the Sierra Club.
Wow.
And so that's what she did, is gave me a one-year membership to the Sierra Club, and that opened up a lot of outdoor opportunities, and also opened up the, you know, thinking about environmental things.
Okay, Bob, hang on a second. I'm gonna jump in and go back to the Scouts for a minute. Did you get an Eagle Scout?
Yes, I advanced through the ranks and eventually became Eagle. And my dad, I always remember, I think it was when I was trying to get my first class badge, I got so upset because I didn't quite understand all this first aid stuff.
Hmm.
I said, I want to, you know, I don't want to be in the Boy Scouts anymore. I want to drop out of the Boy Scouts. And my dad set me down in the living room and talked and talked and talked and convinced me that, you know, this is just a bump in the road, you know. You'll understand it. Mr. Piper will help you understand it, and you'll do fine. And so he encouraged me in that way to you know, to remain with the Boy Scouts.
So in those days,
yes,
I think the Scouts required a lot of projects. You had to do first aid and a number of other things. But there was also a service component or a project component. What did you do for that? Do you remember?
I think what, you know, it's been so long ago, you know, you'd think it would be
well, it was only 50 years ago. No, 55, something like that.
I think I did stuff with the American Cancer Association. And I think, I don't know if it was so much a works project as a you know, volunteer help project with them. You know, everything from stuffing envelopes to you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything more specific than that.
Okay, a community service project
in
a way.
It was more of a community service type thing that I did, yes, that's
nice.
Correct.
Okay, so now let's jump back again to the Sierra Club. When Mrs. Warner gave you that 1 year Sierra Club membership, do you remember how old you were? Roughly, would you have been 15, 16? Or?
Yeah, I'm going to say around 15. Yeah, 14, 15, probably 15. Because later on, then I started doing, you know, activities with the Sierra Club. And what I did was, of course, I had monthly magazine. And that was very influential on me because there were a lot of things going on at that time in the 60s. There were the redwood trees. They were worried about them being clear cut in Northern California. There was the flooding of Glen Canyon. There was the potential flooding of Dinosaur, so on and so forth. All of these
well, certainly Marble Canyon would have been
Marble
the Grand dam
Canyon,
at
Ridge
the time,
Canyon and all that, all those different types of dams.
Uh-huh.
That was all on the forefront. So I became, you know, very active in that sort of thing. And I even wrote letters and things when I was a kid. And I know I supported very strongly the East Bay Regional Park District when they went for trying to get a bond or get, I guess they were getting bonds or something to develop these areas and not develop them, but to preserve these areas around for the people in the Bay Area, for their regional park system.
And did you go on outings?
Yes, I went on a lot of outings with the. I started hiking, and right at first, you know, I'd go on the 5 mile hikes. Pretty soon, that just wasn't enough. You know, I'd go on longer and longer hikes. 5 miles didn't seem like enough, but I went all over the place. I went all over Mount Tamalpais. The Dipsy Trail over in Marin County. You used to go from Mill Valley to Muir Woods and then out to the ocean and back.
Wow.
And that was a pretty common hike. Went down to Big Basin several times in Santa Cruz County, Mount Diablo, went on Mount Diablo a couple of times. Went up to a place, I can't remember exactly where it was. It was either in Sonoma or Napa County that was very cool, called Devil's Hole Falls. And it was in a lava area. So it must have been around Mount St. Helena or something like that.
I'm gonna just
a real interesting place.
Lob a far one to you to see if you catch this. Vicky Hoover? Does that ring a bell?
No.
Still in the Sierra Club today in her 70s. She would have been in the club at that time, and she's just got this long history with the club. So I just want to throw that out there.
No, I don't recognize that name.
Okay, no worries.
I did, then I went, I took an overnight, there was a guy named Denny Reeves, R-E-E-V-E-S, and he lived in Lafayette, and I just happened to meet him on one of these outings, and I asked him if he would be willing to, you know, drive me around to these various places. And so we would coordinate. He was quite a bit, you know, he was had kids and everything, and young kids. He was my transportation to a lot of these things rather than my parents, because I was too young to drive at the time.
Oh, great. And he lived in Walnut Creek? He lived nearby?
He lived in Lafayette, which is just adjacent to Walnut Creek.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so my mom would drive me over to his place, and then he would go from there.
Nice.
And one of the trips we took was up to Yosemite. We went to Illilouette Falls. We came off of Glacier Point down to Illilouette Falls, went up Illilouette Creek, and back, and that was at least an overnight, might have been 3 nights, And that was a lot of fun. And I remember experiencing creek levels coming up and during the day. You don't expect that, you know. And on the way back, the creeks were higher than when we had the spring runoff.
Was that
And when we'd gone, we had.
was that your first time backpacking, or had you done some actual backpacking where you had to load up a pack and carry it on your back? Had you done that with the Boy Scouts?
Did that with the Boy Scouts a little bit, yeah. But most of it was, I don't remember any long backpacks. They were pretty short duration,
Okay.
and with the Boy Scouts. But I and the probably the biggest adventure I had, I was about 15, 15 and a half. I begged my mom to go through Glen Canyon before the dam was. Before they closed the gates of the dam. And
Which was
she,
1963.
yeah, this was 63. She didn't want to, that was the year of the trip, was 1963. So, yeah, that made me 15. And she didn't really want me to go because we'd seen, I Search for Adventure and all these TV shows and people crashing in rafts and going up the Salmon River and all these huge water. Rapids and stuff,
Right.
but she agreed to go over to Berkeley where there was a guy named I think it was Lou Elliott, and he was the owner of American River Tours, and they were the
Well,
ones that were
yeah,
offering this trip.
Lou
And
actually was the outings director for the Sierra Club before he started American.
okay, that's what the connection is then, yeah. And so we went over to Lou's office in Berkeley, and he settled my mom's nerves and told her that there really weren't any rapids in Glen Canyon,
Cool.
that basically it was a quiet float, but there were all these beautiful things to see, obviously. And so I sort of went along as a swamper, and what I did was we found another family friend, who actually one of the my mom's teacher acquaintances. Her son went along with me. I guess that was my mom decided I could go if she could have somebody else go along with me, you know.
Okay.
So anyway, we I'm trying to think of his name now, but I'll probably think of it later in the conversation here. But
So hang on a second. Let's back up a minute. You went to visit Lou, but at that time, Lou Elliott was he in capacity as outings with the club, or was he by then doing American touring, or was American touring providing the trip for the club? Do you remember those details? It's
I think I don't know his association with the Sierra Club. I know that his American River Tours were providing the trip through the canyon,
Okay.
and I don't know if he was still associated with the Sierra Club or not. I really don't know
Yeah,
that.
no worries.
But it was what we did is they had this old stake big 1940 vintage truck, and we met him over in Berkeley. And I had all my personal gear, and Chuck Watson was the kid's name. His mom's name was Joan, and he was going along with me. And we got in this old truck, and we headed for Sacramento. And it was a really a great adventure. I mean, we had dinner there in Sacramento, and then we went over to. I guess we hit Davis before we went there because we had to pick up somebody else that was going along as a boatman. And then when we headed, it was kind of like a marathon. I mean, they never stopped. The only time they stopped was change drivers,
Wow.
and we drove,
Through the night.
down through trying to think, the San Rafael Swell there, and down. I mean, it was just this terrible, rough road past Capitol Reef, and we ended up at Hite.
Right. So you guys would have come in off the north from San Francisco. You went to Sacramento. You would have gone up over the
Went through Richfield that way.
through
Richfield, Utah.
yeah, but I'm before you got to Richfield, you would have gone up over the Donner Pass, is that right? And then down to Reno, and then further off toward Utah, Salt Lake, and then down that way to get how did that quite work?
Yeah, you got me. I don't
Yeah.
know.
Okay. Well, we're not gonna
I don't know
stress
if they were. It was either probably
that.
Highway 50 or 50 or 40. I don't know which one we were on
Okay.
there, but
Okay.
yeah.
And this is like must have been so let's back up a minute. Was this your first time east of the Sierras? Had you traveled off into the deserts at all? It sounds like there's a lot of traveling in California with the Audubon in sort of
Right.
local areas with the Sierra Club, then up into the Sierras some, but was this your first time east?
Yeah, it pretty much was. My parents, having grown up in Oklahoma, we made a couple of trips to Oklahoma, across to Arizona and New Mexico that
Oh,
way,
okay.
or
Okay.
back looping back through Utah. So I had been through Utah and on the main roads and everything, the salt flats and all that stuff. But
So it wasn't.
this was the first big adventure, probably the first time I really was away from home for any real length of time. We
Nice.
were gone
Okay.
like a week, and this trip was probably life changing. There were a lot of people on the trip that were there was Edgar Wayburn, who was the I think he was president of the Sierra Club. David Brower was on the trip, the executive director of the Sierra Club,
Okay.
and a whole bunch of other people that I'm sure were well known in environmental circles and others, but I don't really remember any of their names.
Did you have a
Just those
camera?
two people. I had a camera. I had a an 8mm Kodak Brownie camera, and I also had a 35mm camera. And I don't know. I didn't take that many pictures with my 35mm for some reason, or maybe I didn't have one at all. I'm trying to remember now. Let me see. I'm wondering if we, because I know I had some pictures, some still pictures that I took of some canyon walls and some redbud trees and things like that. But I don't have a lot of pictures, and I'm wondering if I didn't have a print made from the 8mm film,
Do you
which
still
could
have
do.
those films?
I do. I don't know where they're at. I've been looking for
Okay.
them for a couple of years. I cannot find. I know I've got it. I know I haven't thrown it away. Somewhere I've got this film of Glen Canyon, and it's pretty interesting.
Keep looking.
You didn't have the automatic focusing that you have now, and light adaption to the camera. So some of the pictures are kind of dark, some of them are too light, some of them are perfect. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
But we went we got to height really early in the morning. I mean, it must have been 1 or 2 o'clock. There was some kind of little structure there, a little house that was abandoned, had a concrete floor. I remember sleeping on that concrete floor, and then in the morning we got up and we had to pump the boats up, and we pumped and pumped and pumped, and I think we'd pumped them up the night before. No, we hadn't. It was too late. We pumped them up in the morning, but then by the time the rest of the group was coming, they were coming across the ferry at height, the cable ferry there. We had to pump them up again because they had lost air, and they had to patch the boats and all that stuff. And so by late afternoon, we took off and we went down as far as White Canyon. So we didn't go very far, and set up camp. And I remember the first first night out, I was running around on the sand dunes barefoot, and I stuck a got a stick stuck in my foot.
Yeah, ouch.
And you know, there we go. You know, I've got my first injury of the trip. You know, I was able to dig it out with my knife and everything, but it kind of bothered me the rest of the trip. You know, we went from there down. You know, the next morning downriver. And I'm not quite sure where we stayed the second night. I think it was Music Temple. We went down, that's quite a ways downriver, though, so that's probably too far. So there was probably a stop in between there and Music Temple, because the San Juan River and the Escalante and all that.
Do you remember a Tapestry Wall or Klondike Bar? There would have been some wooden wooden structure on River Left, the Stanton Dredge, big metal buckets.
I don't remember all that. That's okay. Moki Canyon. That's where we stayed. We stayed at Moki.
Okay.
Moki Canyon, the next night, I think, and because a lot of people walked up to the
ruins up there.
Up and saw Indian ruins, and then we went down. The next day was Music Temple, and we went to. There was another place across. And upstream from that, Hidden Passage, I think it was called.
Yep, sure.
Okay, Hidden Passage. I remember going up there and hiking a ways up into Hidden Passage, and then a group of people went further up, and I turned around and went back over. They took us back over across the river to Music Temple. And that was really an amazing place, and I remember going in and seeing what I thought was graffiti on the wall there. And it actually says, you know, J.W. Powell,
yeah.
1869,
Dylan Bond,
or something,
yeah.
Like that, you know, all these names. And then we spent the evening in there, and people singing, you know, and it was just an amazing,
wow.
Absolutely amazing place. A few people sounded like a choir in some European chapel, you know. I mean, it just was unbelievable. And then we went from there downriver, and I'm kind of vague as to where we helped, if we had two more nights or just one more night.
Did you hike up to Rainbow Bridge?
We did. Okay, that's where we stayed.
Okay.
Yeah, you reminded me. We did hike the Rainbow Bridge, and
you with your stick in your foot hobbling along.
Oh yeah, I wasn't that bad off.
Okay, good.
It was quite a ways. It was like seven
yeah.
miles up
yeah.
there and back,
yep.
and we hiked up there. And I remember when you came around the corner and you saw that bridge, and you were down below. You weren't up at what is now lake level up to Lake Powell. You were down below looking up at the bridge. And it was just breathtaking, you know, to see that for the first time. And
did you hike up to the top of
the bridge?
Okay, under the bridge. Did you hike up to the top of the bridge?
No, we didn't have time to do anything like that. And
we
did hike back. Oh, I know another guy that was on this on the trip. Elliot Porter was his name.
Uh-huh.
He was a famous photographer and contributor to their, their format book series here,
yes.
And the place that no one knew is all his photographs. And I remember, you know, on the way to the bridge, walking by, and he's got this tripod and a camera set up, and he's just waiting there, you know, waiting for just the right light to
yeah.
take these pictures. You know, it was amazing, and I have that book here in my collection in Montrose where I live, and I sure wish I could have had him sign it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, do you remember at the bottom of the bridge there was a register, a fairly large register book. Now that all, by 1960 or 61, the register was becoming a place for people to express their anger about the construction of Glen Canyon Dam, and so the whole register was taken away. But I just wondered, did you guys sign, do you remember signing a register at all there?
No, I don't remember doing that, but probably did, you know, but I don't remember.
All right.
We, you know, later on in my career, after I left Grand Canyon, I went to Dinosaur, and then from Dinosaur I went to Glen Canyon, and then from Glen Canyon I moved up here to the Kurikani Black Canyon area where I ended my career. I sort of didn't want to go back to Glen Canyon because I knew what had been lost, but I did it for, like so many park rangers, for career
mm-hmm.
enhancement
sure.
Needs, you know. And we still had a register of sorts up there at Rainbow Bridge at that time. And I can't remember if it was what its location was. I think maybe it was up on the boundary where you came in to the park from the other side, from the Navajo Mountain side.
Okay.
But I do recall all of these notes on there, you know, flood the bridge, don't flood the bridge, knock the bridge down, you know, all this, this back and forth political garbage that people were still expressing themselves even in the 1970s there. So
yeah, okay.
Yeah,
let's go back to that trip, and so, you know, Elliot Porter's there, David Brower's there. I'm assuming that the campfire talk would have been talking about the environmental issues of the day. Do you remember those discussions at all? Do you remember, I mean, listen, as a 16-year-old kid, there's a lot of stuff happening. It's this gorgeous country. It's a fun river. There's water. There's mud. There's sand. There's hiking. I'm just trying to wonder, you know.
I think I probably didn't get as involved in that stuff, but I do remember some of the issues that they talked about, and one of them was that there was alternative means of power generation other than putting Glen Canyon Dam online.
You bet.
And they did it though at that time. David Brower was talking about the potential of, you know, coal and other types of energy sources. Of course, it's kind of ironic that they would talk about that, I guess, now, because they're, you know, they supported it one time and then opposed it the next. But that, you know, that said, they were looking for other alternative energy.
Right.
Supplies. And I remember those discussions. They were talking about that a lot.
And that actually, you know, came to pass with the construction of the Navajo Generating Station at Page.
That's right.
In lieu of
right.
Marble Canyon Dam. So
that's right.
You know, so those are definitely, and of course, the generating plant, the coal-fired plant, generates way more electricity than the dam does. So
sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, yeah. Neat. So they were talking about that. Excellent.
Yeah, they were definitely talking about that sort of thing, and they, you know, they had won the battle at Dinosaur, saved Dinosaur. I remember they talked about that some, and they held out hope that they might be able to you know, keep them from closing the gates of the dam, because it was just literally weeks away or days away that they were getting ready to. There was some. A little bit of impoundment taking place,
right?
As we got in the lower stretches there, you know, as you reached toward Walweep and that area.
So at that point, they were taking river trips out at a place called Cane Creek. Do you remember that at all?
Yes. Uh huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it was someplace other than Walweep and
right.
all that. I remember we had a long dusty drive.
Yes.
Back to Page. You
yep.
know, and,
yep.
Where I got the bus and went home.
Do you remember the names of anybody else on the trip? Do you remember who the boatmen were or any of the passengers besides who you've already told me?
One of the boatmen was Lou Elliott's son. I think it was Bob Elliott, I think his name was.
Okay.
But I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think his name, he was the one that was actually, Lou Elliott wasn't on the trip, but his son Bob was, And then there was another boatman that I just can't remember. I do not remember his name. I was more into the scenery and
Sure.
the hiking and having fun than you know, the social aspect of it
Yeah.
and learning everybody's name. So
Okay.
that we later, after the trip was over, I guess it was a month or two later, we got invited to David Brower's house in Berkeley, and everybody from the trip went to his home, and showed pictures, and I showed my movie, you know, and everything, and it was a really fun time. And my parents got to go with me, you know, so they enjoyed doing that.
Nice. So they had a chance to see the adventure they sent you out on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Fun.
And the people that I was with. So.
Were you thinking about college at this time?
Yes, I had thought about, you know, I guess you think about college, but I was really, I'm not sure if it was in my plans, you know, where I absolutely positively had to do it. Certainly, you know, my mom, who was a graduate of she eventually got a master's degree from the University of California and had all of her work done to get her PhD.
Wow.
But she decided to not pursue that, and one of the reasons is she got so discouraged in the public school system at the time, you know, the glass ceiling and all. She just could not. Here she had a higher, you know, was more educated than the principals and some of the other teachers, and yet she couldn't get a principalship, which she really wanted, you know, in
Wow.
schools or anything. So she had just decided not to do that, you know. So.
Wow, interesting. And don't think about that. You do think about women being teachers, but you don't think about them not being allowed to be principals, as you say, you know, glass ceiling. And so she, do you think she saw that even if she'd gotten her PhD, it wouldn't have helped her?
That's what she felt.
Wow.
Why do it?
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
why hit my head against the wall? But she really encouraged me, and my dad too, to go to college. You know, my dad said he used all through life. My dad was not totally illiterate, but he could not read well, and I don't know if he, you know, had maybe dyslexia or something, or
Okay.
whether he just could not read. But he always would say, you know, if with my drive, if I just had an education, I could do anything, you know. So he encouraged both myself and my brother to get a good education, because he wasn't, my dad was not stupid by any means, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was a very smart guy, and he was sort of and this I learned from him, you know, is he was sort of a jack of all trades. He could, it always seemed like me when I was a kid, that he could fix anything, you know. He
Nice.
was always, mechanically, he was really adept. And but he had trouble both reading and writing, and he would pull little tricks like forget to bring his glasses, you know, to dinner, and have my mom read the menu to him, you know, and
Uh-huh.
stuff like that. So,
Yeah.
but he, both of them encouraged me to go to college, and I applied. Well, during my senior year in high school, I did a project on Coulter pine trees. Coulter pine is a looks a lot like a ponderosa, has real dark green long leaves, and has the heaviest of all pine cones.
Huh.
In fact, I've still got two of them here in my bedroom here that I got 50 years ago from this little grove of
Wow.
Coulter pines I worked with on Mount Diablo. On the northeast side of Mount Diablo is this little grove. It's the most northern grove of Coulter pines. And they're not rare, but they're not real common, and they extend down the coast mountains of California into Southern California, and I think into Upper Baja and that area.
Oh, okay. Huh.
And so I did this study, and I went to I got a science award and went down to, they had a science fair at Stanford University, and I went down there, and I didn't win any of their awards, but I did get to participate and present my project and stuff.
Cool.
And basically I was trying to determine, I was taking core samples, and I borrowed a core from the University of California and their forestry department, and I cored a lot of these trees to see how old they were and everything, and I was comparing them to the digger pine that they were associated with, and trying to see if maybe there was any evidence that they were being replaced or in stress or distress or those types of things.
Uh-huh.
And it was a fun project, and I had a lot of trouble, getting people to go out and help me. I'd get my high school buddies to try to go out, and it was like pulling teeth, but
yeah.
I got some help, to go out and do these this project. And when it got time to apply to college, I applied at two places. One was Stanford University, and the other was the University of California, Berkeley. And I got accepted at Berkeley. I did not get accepted at Stanford, but I did get accepted at Berkeley. And I remember going over and having to, you had to write an essay, and they had you come over to Wheeler Auditorium there and write this essay. And if you did a good job on your essay, then you could go right into an English class or whatever. If you didn't, then you had to take what they call bonehead English or subject A. Well, I had to take subject A, and ended up having to have this remedial English course before I could take any other speech or English classes at Cal.
Okay.
But
what were you thinking at that time? You wanted to major in, or were you just thinking, well, let me just take some courses and see where this goes?
I was majoring in forestry. I wanted to major
okay.
in forestry. So I took all these classes for forestry, and then between my sophomore and junior year, you were required to go up to a summer camp in Quincy, California, northeast California. And that was kind of prerequisite. The things that you learned and studied up there were sort of prerequisite to what you were going to do in your junior, senior year. So I went up there, and I got ill about the second week I was there. I've always had, bad allergies. I tell people, anything with fur or pollen, I'm allergic to. So
it's a hard row for
pretty,
a forester.
Yeah, I got pretty sick, and I had to leave the camp, and I was just devastated. So I didn't know what to do. I got back to Cal, and I got to looking at all the different majors and what I'd taken for my first 2 years, and I settled on geography, and also biology. Those were those two, that's what I worked on. And it was really a pretty good major to get into. I took a lot of because the department was pretty small, a lot of graduate classes and stuff.
Nice.
A lot of graduate students in classes with me. So from that standpoint, it was, ended up being a pretty good education. And I graduated out. I had to go one extra quarter. In fact, I worked at Grand Canyon my first season, and then I had to go back to Cal, and my last quarter was the fall of 69. So then I graduated. I infamously graduated with a class of 70. It would have been a class of 70 in the fall, but they had riots at Cal, and it was the only graduation ceremony in the university's history they canceled. So I've never actually walked with my class, because the same thing happened with me in high school. Not the same thing, but it's something similar. I graduated from Pleasant Hill High School in 1965, and I put in for a National Science Foundation scholarship. I had a really good biology teacher named Enid Larson, E-N-I-D Larson, and with an E, I think. And she encouraged me, based on this project I did with the Coulter Pines and other things I'd done in her biology class,
right,
to apply for this scholarship. So I did, and at first I didn't hear from them, so I wrote them a second letter, and they did respond to the second letter, and I got this little scholarship, and it was
nice.
For a summer in near Ward, Colorado, which is with the University of Colorado. It's about 30 miles from Boulder.
Yeah, Ward is about 9,000, 8,000 feet
pretty
on
high.
The east slope, west of Boulder.
North of Nederland west of Boulder.
South
and,
of Rocky Mountain National
this
Park.
This was it was called the Institute of Alpine and Arctic Research. And so this was a really interesting summer. You know, we had glaciologists and botanists and all kinds of people came and gave different programs and stuff. And we went on field trips. We went to Mesa Verde went all over the park there. That it was really fascinating.
Wow.
For 2 days. Went out on the Ute Reservation and saw a lot of their ruins out there. Then we had another field trip. We went down to the Great Sand Dunes, and then we made little local trips. Went up Mount Evans and a few other places like that. So
I was going
to
say, did you climb Long's Peak? Some of the other Brainerd Lake is up there. There's a bunch of interesting stuff up there above Treeline to walk around on. So.
No, I didn't. I hiked. I know one big backpack trip where we went down and over to the headwaters of the South St. Vrain River, and most of my other. They had these little they were insulated, like trailers, insulated from the lightning. And they had these at different locations. So several times I got permission, went up and sort of camped out the night up in these things. One was at 11.3, and one was at 10.3, and one was at 9,700 feet, I think.
Okay.
And one reason you don't do things is you don't have much money.
Yeah.
So that was one reason I didn't do a lot of backpacking out and away from the lodge area, you know. Mm. Plus getting transportation, I didn't have a car. So,
okay.
In fact,
wow.
that created a real interesting scenario. I had an aunt, a great aunt, that lived in Longmont, Colorado, which is north of Boulder, north and east of Boulder. And I decided I was going to go see this great aunt. Her name was Aunt Maud, M-A-U-D-E, Aunt Maud, and she was my grandmother's sister. My grandmother was
on your father's side or on your mother's side?
On my mother's side.
Okay.
Was Cherokee heritage. She was half Cherokee, and so this was her sister. Her maiden name was Maud Sixkiller.
Wow.
And my grandmother was Mary Ann Sixkiller. And so I decided I was going to go see her. Well, I asked around camp on Friday, and no one was going in. There was one professor there that I really liked, and I thought his name was Harold Lutz, L-U-T-Z. He was from Yale University. He was a forester. And I went to him, and I was hoping he would give me a ride into Boulder, but he wouldn't. And he couldn't, that not wouldn't, but he couldn't. And then there was this group of of maintenance guys. Well, I had driven up the mountain with them when they drove like maniacs, so I was not going to get back in the car with them and go down to Boulder. So I decided to walk, and they had me in a little cabin in the woods with this guy, and I didn't tell him what I was doing. I just said, "Well, I'm gonna take off for a couple of days," and out the door I went, you know, and I walked all night. It took me all night to walk from the lodge to Boulder, and I got in there as I was just
at down Nine Mile Canyon or something like that. It's a long walk.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. And I got down near the bus station, and I saw the silhouette of the mountains. It was starting to get daylight, you know. I thought, I'm not going to make it to the bus in time. And I just kept walking, and I got there about 15 minutes before the bus left at 7 o'clock in the morning. Got on the bus. Of course, I was exhausted. Got up to Longmont. My aunt picked me up, or I guess I walked to her house, and then spent the weekend with her and got to know her a little bit, you know. And then my cousins, I had some cousins in Denver, they drove up and drove me back up to the lodge. So
thank heavens.
It was quite an adventure for me, you know, especially at night, you know. You'd be going along and dogs would be barking and stuff. And people be switching their porch lights on, you know, wondering who's out there on the highway. So, but yeah, I did some pretty crazy stuff when I was younger.
Nice. Very nice. So looking at the clock here, we've been yik-yakking for about an hour and 20 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe this is a good place to wrap up part one interview. And then in part two, we can pick up more with your schooling, and then head off from there.
Okay.
Do you have anything else you want to add to this before we wrap this interview up?
Well, not that comes to mind that's that important. So.
Okay. Well, let's
appreciate you calling. It's an honor to be able to talk to you.
No worries. Hold the line for a minute.
Yeah.
I'm just going to voice this out. This is the first part of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Bob Wheeler. Today is Monday. It's May 28th, 2018. And hold the line for a minute, Bob.